Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to take an adventure with rugged capability and commanding style. Check out the Honda Ridgeline, Pilot, Passport, or CRV. For a limited time, well-qualified buyers can get a 1.99% APR on a 2025 Ridgeline or a 3.99% APR on a 2025 Pilot, 2026 Passport, or 2025 CRV.
See dealer for financing details.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 473. On the podcast today, I have the CEO of Phalanx Group. That's FLX, John Blamire, talks about their recent acquisition and placing. Worth listening to this, actually. And I ask every CEO who comes on the podcast, name three reasons why you think an investor should put your company on their watch list. And if you think this company is worth putting on your watch list, click follow on the Vox Markets app. Also on the podcast, CEO of Forbidden Technologies, Aziz Moussa. That's FBT. And we talk about lots of things. Share price had a bit of a rally recently. And also mentioned that agreement with Microsoft. Yeah. Also on the podcast, who is it now? Who was that? Somebody else, wasn't it? Oh, yeah. Non-executive chairman of much discussed Andlas Energy and Power. That's ADL, Paul Warwick. Paul has an amazing CV. And I remember chatting to Dave Whitby, and he said, when you look at Paul's CV, it makes you question what we've done with our lives. Because he's, you know, packed so much in. It's phenomenal. Worth listening to this, this chat. Because he's a man of knowledge. He's well known in the oil and gas industry. And it makes you question, along with Dave, if you check out their CVs, why are they now at a small company like Andlas? You know, an amazingly strong board. Yeah. So it's worth listening. And again, I asked Paul three reasons why an investor should put you on the watch list. And if you're convinced by that, then please do go to the Vox Markets app. Just type in the ticker there, ADL, and hit follow. Also on the podcast, I have today's suggested stock with potential. That's Amrit, AMYT. Check that out.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chief Executive Officer of Phalanx Group. That's FLX. It's John Blamire. Thanks for coming back on, John.
Hi, Justin. It's great to be back.
Yeah, now, take us through, before we start on the RNS that was released today, take us through for new listeners and for people who haven't heard about the company. What do you do, John, at Phalanx?
Well, we do effectively two main things in our business now. We are, on the one hand, a bespoke provider of business intelligence products to FTSE 100, FTSE 250, NASDAQ companies. And we also provide government-grade cybersecurity, and we currently have five UK government departments consuming our managed services, and now we've augmented that with the acquisition of Advanced Security Consulting.
Yeah, and it's no secret, you know. There's always, I mean, there was one recently about this cybersecurity threat, and I think it was a Bank of Bangladesh, I think, was lifted of several hundred million dollars. So we know the more, you know, sophisticated the internet becomes, it's almost like these cyber criminals are almost one step ahead. So it's like catching them, isn't it? We know it's a growing industry, isn't it?
Oh, it's massively growing. I mean, we see this now as the growth sector from not just a technology perspective, but just across the broad commercial piece. It's the fast, high growth sector for the next 10 years. I've heard that being repeated time and time again. It's the space to be in.
And you're the man, really, to head this up, because I was looking at your background. You're from the British Army, and you headed up over 60 people in the intelligence sector, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And although we weren't using sophisticated cybersecurity techniques back then, there was the adoption of using modern intelligence practices and trying to understand how people and organizations, both criminal and terrorist, were organizing and operating. And there are some similarities in being able to take that thought process and bring it across into the commercial security sector.
Yeah, okay, well, let's go through today's RNS, which is the acquisition and the placing and issue of loan notes. And first of all, let's talk about the acquisition. Tell me about that, John.
Yeah, well, it's very exciting. So ASC is run by a gentleman and was founded also by a gentleman called Jay Abbott. Jay is recognised as, throughout the UK as being one of the industry's leading experts in cybersecurity. He sits on a number of committees, including Tech UK. And we're very, very pleased to have him on board. He would be, you know, the go-to man for an awful lot of very large organizations. He brings with him a whole book of a very valuable business. And ASC has been growing, in fact, it's been doubling in size for the last 3 years. And currently it looks like it's going to do that again this coming year. And also now we have fantastic synergies between our government grade services that we provide. And now his commercial consultancy wrap on top will allow us to take our gov-grade cybersecurity services out of our managed security operations center in Reading and deliver those into commercial organizations at a very, very acceptable price point, which will be very disruptive in the market.
Okay, and straight away, I'm reading the RNS here, it says it will be immediately earnings enhancing.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, because we've been lining this this deal up for a while now, ASC's been holding a whole book of business waiting for us to get through the acquisition piece so they can start to scale to the requirements of the client. So we got not just the business that ASC's been doing throughout the year on their normal growth run rate, but we've also got a whole book of extra business that's about to be executed as well. So it's very exciting.
Okay, and so how much does this cost to buy ASC?
It costs just over £450,000 in total. £150,000 of that was in cash and the rest was in shares. So it hasn't been a cash-intensive deal. And also, Jay Abbott being the owner and proprietor of that business, he's being incentivized by stock and he's now locked in to that stock for the next 3 years. So he's not going anywhere and he's not selling any shares. He is committed to driving value into Phalanx Group.
Okay, so that seems very positive. Now, the shares are off a bit today, and I think it's attached to the placing here. So take us through the placing to raise money. To raise £1.55 million, take us through the detail and why you think maybe it's the share price is taking a knock.
Well, I think it's very simple, but let me just say that we raised just over 1 million, and that's exactly what we were looking for. For 1 million, we were slightly oversubscribed, but we went to current shareholders to subscribe directly to the company. So we didn't go out and have a roadshow. We just wanted a limited amount of capital raised within a small group of current shareholders. That was successful. We wanted to augment that with a bit of debt, which would then reduce the dilution of taking on more equity because we recognised we needed the £1.5 million to complete the integration of ASC and also to get us to break even in the cybersecurity piece. But I think it's people's perception of the provider of the loan note, which I know Darwin has had a history of providing some toxic debt to some companies in the past. And I've seen the chat rooms, people said, oh, it's a death spiral, etc. Nothing could be further from the truth. It is a straightforward convertible loan note mm-hmm. with a 10% coupon and a 10 pence, say again, 10 pence conversion price. So way out of the money. It also has some warrants attached at 8p, and on redemption of the loan, the warrants are halved in number, and the company has the option to enforce the acquisition of those warrants at 8p by Darwin. So it is a proper, straightforward, grown-up, normal, vanilla, convertible loan note.
I like the way you say a proper grown-up loan note. So, I think people have seen that Darwin and they almost not read the detail here. Is that the case, you think?
I think so, but I wouldn't like to go back into the history of other companies that have taken different types of loan or debt mechanisms in the past. All I can say is Darwin have been very, very good with us. They provided us with a very straightforward facility, which has been very, very helpful for the company going forward, and will help us achieve our aims. And I can't really thank them enough.
Marvellous. All right, John, well, listen, I think you've spelled that out and dispelled a few worries or queries there. But if anyone needs any more convincing, give us three reasons, John, why someone should put Phalanx Group on their watch list.
Well, first of all, we are in the most exciting high growth space, that of cybersecurity, and will be for the next 10 years. And when now in at the ground level and growing with that that market growth curve. So that's one. Mm-hmm. Secondly, with the acquisition of ASC, we've now got the ability to offer our government grade cybersecurity services into the commercial space with a combination of ASC's channels and consultancy, which is great. That's the whole reason why we bought ASC. And now we're also seeing the excellent cross-selling opportunities between our intelligence company, which holds those 80 or so FTSE 100, FTSE 250 clients, and our now enlarged cybersecurity division. And we were having difficulty seeing that cross-selling opportunity earlier because we didn't have that consultancy capability, and now we've got that, and that's what's really starting to generate the throughput of sales on the cybersecurity piece, but also allows us to send guys to engage with the intelligence clients so they can also start to look and adopt our cybersecurity offering.
Marvellous, John, it's lovely to chat to you, and I'm sure you'll have plenty of news coming up in the next few months, so let's chat again very soon. Thanks very much, John.
Great, Justin. Speak to you again soon. Take care.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Wade.
And joining me on the podcast right now is CEO of Forbidden Technologies. That's FBT ticker. It's Aziz Moussa. Thanks for joining me again, Aziz.
Thanks, Justin.
Now, your share price has had a nice little rally last few days, and I assume it's because of some of the positive announcements you've made. But let's we'll go through those in a bit. But if someone who's new to the podcast or has never heard of Forbidden Technologies, what's it all about, Aziz? What do you do there?
Forbidden Technologies has a stack of IP in cloud video editing. So that's editing video in a browser. Basically, we have three products and we serve multiple markets. Our main product is Foreseen. It serves broadcast. So if you watch any long-form television like The Voice or Come Dine With Me or things like that, we're normally involved with that. And the advantage we bring to that market is that we can reduce the cost of post-production by 20 to 25%, sometimes more. And also it works in sports and news. And the advantage that we bring to that space is that our technology can distribute live content to digital media. So a goal that's just been scored in the Champions League to an app or to a website or to Facebook or Twitter faster than anyone else in the market. Okay. That's our main product. We also have Captivate, an online video editor for the mass market. It's the simplest video editor available to consumers. It's captivatewithane.com, and listeners can go and get a free trial now at captivate.com. And we also have Eva, which is a UGC platform, a user-generated content platform for brands to own and control user-generated content.
Okay, so let's go back through some of the RNSs and find out the reasons why the share price has been rising. Now, I'm going to go back to March the 16th, and you did an agreement with Microsoft. Take us through that, Aziz.
Absolutely. It's probably the one of the biggest deals we've ever signed. It allows Foreseen to be sold on the Microsoft Azure marketplace. Essentially, what it does is it gives us access to Microsoft's thousands of salespeople around the world. We are in the process of training them on our platform, and they will sell Foreseen to their clients. Azure, for those who don't know, is just the cloud storage. So essentially it's a commodity, and they're always in price degradation. And so the only way that they can really differentiate themselves from IBM and Amazon and every other cloud storage provider is with value-added services. Media is a massive sector for cloud storage, obviously, because video takes up so much space within storage. And so Foreseen is the only professional video editor available on the Azure platform, and the Microsoft team are excited to get out there and sell it.
Wow, that must have been an exciting deal to sign off, wasn't it?
Yeah, incredibly exciting. I think the whole all of this year has been and will continue to be really exciting. It's this is a company that has been around for a long time, and it has historically always been a technology company run by a technologist and thinking technology first. And really, since I took over as chief executive, it's we've been undergoing a commercial pivot. We've been removing costs from R&D and reapplying it to our sales force, growing our sales team to the biggest that it's ever been. The natural consequence of that is that we end up signing lots of deals and bigger deals.
Yeah. So initially, before Foreseen was available for people, I mean, sort of companies, what would they use if it's not cloud based? They use what software based on the computer? Would they?
Yes, absolutely. And typically, they're high capex spend. So the three key players are Adobe, Apple, and then the gorilla in the market is a company called Avid. And essentially, what a production company would do is that they would buy the technology and then all of the hardware that goes with that technology. Now, normally speaking, we go hand in hand with all of those products. What we offer in terms of a cost saving is in the first part of editing. So without getting too technical, basically editing a TV, if you're making Come Dine With Me as a TV show, you've got two types of editing. The first one is that you've recorded 100 hours of content, you need to make a 30-minute show. That's the storytelling editing. Mm-hmm. And then the second bit is once you've got that 30 minutes is grading, color correction, really high-end, high-processor power stuff.
Yeah.
What our technology does is it significantly reduces the cost of that first bit because you don't need all of that hardware. You don't need to rent a space to do that. You can do it on your iPad or on a train or on your laptop, wherever you want. But we don't really get involved in the second bit. So people still use their Avids and the like for that online, that high-end editing solution.
Okay, all right, and so let's skip forward to a few days back, May the 3rd, a new sporting event using Foreseen. Take us through that as well, please.
Sure. So we've got sports is a growth sector for us. We grew 188% in sport last year, and that continues to be the case this year. And I need to do some linguistic gymnastics here to make sure that I don't mention the client names. We're not able to mention the client names, but people should basically be able to guess them. We have two new sporting events. The first is a global tennis tournament that's not far away from home. And the second, also in the summer, is an athletic sporting event for the disabled out in Brazil. These two events are using our technology to get small snippets of content and then distribute them to either their websites or to their app or to their Facebook and Twitter pages.
Yeah.
And the reason...
Go on.
Just to say that the reason that that's important for sporting events is that historically, if you wanted to see the highlights of a sporting event, you'd wait till the evening and you'd watch TV. But people are increasingly consuming the highlights as they're happening through digital media, through Facebook or Twitter or through apps. And we get that content out to people's digital media quicker than anyone else.
Yeah. I love that. I'm reading the RS. I mean, I don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out what... I'm not going to mention what they are, but the new news in the RS is new sporting event is a global tennis tournament occurring in London. And
yeah.
And the other one you mentioned, wow, I wonder what. But yeah, so you can see, high-profile events there. And another positive RS, so you've got... paid proof of concept with a broadcaster. Take us to the details on that, please, Aziz.
So, yes, we announced this yesterday. It's been a deal in the making since November. There's two elements to it. The first one is the client, who a British-based broadcaster who, we've been after for some time. They have a significant focus on cost reduction, particularly within their factual department, the department that creates factual TV. And they're using cloud-based workflows now, using Foreseen throughout this proof of concept to drive cost efficiency. The proof of concept is 12 months. It's a paid and it's a full, it's as if they're a real client for those 12 months. So they're paying full price. There's no discount to it. But we don't expect the proof of concept to last the full 12 months. We expect to be able to prove the cost saving benefits sooner. That in itself is really exciting. That client, if they were to take on Foreseen across their department and then beyond that department too, would make them far and away the largest client within our portfolio. But actually, that's not the most exciting part of the deal for me. The most exciting part is the integration with the technology partner. So the technology partner is a US giant. Everybody knows who they are. They are probably more famous in consumer technology than they are in professional, but they have a professional editing solution that this particular broadcaster uses. And we approached them in November, as we did, in fact, everybody else within our space, looking to integrate our technology into theirs. They just have a bigger customer base, so it was an opportunity to rapidly grow our revenues through partnership. And they were receptive from the start. They just wanted a mutual client. We found the mutual client, and so we've completed the technical integration. If that's successful, then it opens up access to their millions of customers that we could then address. So, you know, a really, really significant deal for us. And again, just proof as to how this commercial pivot is starting to unfold.
Yeah, it does seem, and I hear this a lot, you know, you hear CEOs say it's the inflection point, but you seem with these deals to be hooking up with a lot of, you know, gold standard clients. And do you feel like you are getting, you know, definite traction here at the moment?
Well, we are getting definite traction. I think that our numbers at the half year will reflect that. I think that we're getting traction. I think that there's an element of how far can we go, and I wouldn't want to call this an inflection point. I think it's the start of a different focus within the organization. Our technology is essentially irreplicable, so we offer genuine benefits to the market. We went from only ever having 1.8 people selling product to very rapidly by the end of Q1 we had 7 people selling product, and we're just seeing the benefits of that. It hasn't, I'll be honest with you, Justin, it hasn't been rocket science. You get more people selling product and you sell more product.
Yeah. I was interested to see you had 1.8 people selling a product. Yeah. How does that work? So that 0.8 person was quite small.
Yeah, so it's spread over a few different people.
Oh, I see. Okay, it makes sense, of course. And if you've got the product there and you get people, you know, spreading the word there and proving the concept, then it's bound to get more traction. Marvellous. Well, listen, if anyone needs any more convincing, Aziz, could you give us like 3 reasons why an investor should put Forbidden Technologies on their watch list?
The first one I would say is because we have more salespeople than ever before, and as a natural consequence, we're driving our commercial pivot into reality. We're converting those salespeople into new revenue, and that'll be reflected in our future results. The second one is that it's an unprecedented year. This 2016 will be an unprecedented year for Forbidden Technologies in terms of the number of announcements that we make, and that's just a natural consequence of what happened last year. So last year we made a very uninteresting £700,000, and we've done that pretty metronomically for a number of years now. This year, however, with more salespeople than ever before, closing more deals than ever before, we have to announce. Our broker insists that we announce the deals that meet the requirements, and there will just be more of that because the base is so low. So it's £70,000 deal this year will need to be announced. Next year, however, given the revenue growth, it won't need to be announced, and therefore this year, just in terms of the volume of announcements, will likely be an unprecedented year for Forbidden Technologies. We've already announced more in Q1 than we did all of last year. And the third reason is because we have actually got a number of products working across a number of markets. We've got a very diversified portfolio, de-risking our growth opportunities, and we're seeing traction across all of our portfolios. So our objective, as I said on our first call some months ago, is our objective is to make Forbidden Technologies a standout British technology company that we can all be proud of. And so we're starting on that mission, and we're already seeing very positive traction.
Yeah, well, it seems like. And listen, like you said, you've announced more this or done more this quarter than you had last year. So I would love to get you back on, Aziz, when you get some more information or more news, because I'm sure that'll be coming out in the not-too-distant future. And we can chat again then. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waits.
And joining me on the podcast right now is non-executive chairman of Andilas Energy and Power. That's ADL, of course. It's Paul Warwick. Thank you for joining me, Paul.
Good morning to you, Justin. Thank you for inviting me.
That's all right. Well, listen, you know, for a while back, you were announced as you are becoming on board at Andilas. And I thought, well, let's check out this Paul Warwick fella then. And I've got to say, I was very impressed with your CV, and you know, you've done a lot of things. In fact, I'll let you go through it. Let you blow your own trumpet here, because it's worth it, I think. Because, you know, a lot of the time people have been investing in Dave and the management there and his ambition at Andilas. And you know, like I said, you've got a powerful board there now. And so let's have a bit of a summary of your CV, if you can, Paul.
Certainly, Justin, and you're very kind with your compliments. So, I would say what I've had is an oil and gas industry career that is similar to several people in the oil industry who have risen to reasonable heights within large oil and gas companies. So I started off interested in the industry in the 1970s, working on projects. I worked in Norway. Actually, my first assignment was in Norway. And then I returned to the UK. I joined Conoco and thereby started a career of 31 years with Conoco and ConocoPhillips. I worked on some of the larger projects within the North Sea, both UK and Norway. And then I worked in Norway with Conoco as well. And then going into commercial work within the Conoco gas organization, and then into operations. And over a period of years in the UK, I ended up running what was called the Southern Gas Basin, which was at the time producing somewhere on the day between 25 and 30% of the UK's gas needs. And I then subsequently became managing director of a business within Trinidad, which Conoco were a part shareholder of. And then progressed with various roles through running Conoco's business in Nigeria, and then moved to a company where I met Dave Whitby called Gulf Indonesia Resources. Conoco had acquired 72% of that company with the Gulf Canada acquisition, and I was asked if I would like to be CEO. Gulf Indonesia Resources was a New York Stock Exchange quoted company, the 28% was quoted, and I did that. Conoco, at the time of the merger with ConocoPhillips, acquired the 28% on the day before, actually. And I then became president of ConocoPhillips Indonesia. So my time in Indonesia was spread over 3 years. And that was a time of, it was a very exciting time. It was a time of extraordinary growth, particularly within the Indonesian gas industry, which both ConocoPhillips and Gulf Indonesia were in the vanguard of. After my time in Indonesia, I went to run the Middle East for ConocoPhillips, so that was based in Qatar, but with businesses in Libya, Dubai, Iraq, Abu Dhabi, Egypt, etc. And so it was what we euphemistically described as a regional president's role. I ended up then, after a few years, moving to Europe, where I ran Europe and Africa, and those were the North African countries and the Nigeria as well. And I then, at the time of the split between ConocoPhillips, the upstream and downstream, I elected to move to Talisman Energy for a career move, where I became executive vice president for what was called Europe Atlantic, which effectively was the European business, the African business, the Middle East business, and the South American business. In addition, I also had the accountability for the corporate technical functions, things like exploration, HSE, projects, drilling, those sorts of technical functions, which I did for the company. And I sat on the top executive team for the company and stayed at Talisman until Repsol acquired them just about a year ago, actually. I think May the 8th was when the deal closed. Then I stayed with Repsol for about 6 months, helping with the transition and operating at what a job in Repsol is called executive director. And but with the intention of leaving that company and retiring at the end of September, which indeed I did, and then followed on joining the Andalas board in December. So that's a potted history, really, of my background.
Wow. Do you know what? When I last spoke to Dave, he said, when you chat to Paul and read through his CV, it makes you wonder what we've been doing with our lives. And I think I would never achieve that much if I lived to 1,000 years of age, because I'm just going through now. And, you know, you're quite modest. Like, you say, president of ConocoPhillips Indonesia, you know, president of Middle East and North Africa, Conoco president of Europe and West Africa, and executive vice president of Talisman Energy. So you were president of ConocoPhillips Indonesia. So you've obviously got a lot of experience in Indonesia. Tell me about that market and, you know, how much you know it. I suppose I've spoken with quite a few people who have operations in Indonesia, and they say you have to know how Indonesia works. Is that right?
Well, I think that's absolutely so. And let me say, you know, I was the beneficiary of a lot of very good teachers when I went to Indonesia. One of them, indeed, was Dave. And we had a team of both Indonesians and expatriate employees who were really, I would say, on the inside track of what was happening in the Indonesian gas industry. The oil industry in Indonesia is equally as complex, but it is somewhat more straightforward at that particular time because it was well developed. And so I worked with a number of people creating things that people had observed for some period of time, but actually hadn't been able to put together. So during my time there, I mentioned it was a period of extraordinary growth in the gas industry. We did things like creating the pipeline company, which is called PT Transgas Indo. I became the what was called the deputy president director of that, which was the in UK and European type speak, was the deputy chairman. And that was a joint venture of a number of companies, including ConocoPhillips. But led particularly by PGN, the state gas company. And then with those relationships with PGN and PLN facilitating gas sales to Batam, the pipeline itself facilitated the delivery of gas to Singapore. And probably the jewel in the crown of the work that we did at that time, working very closely with the government, very closely with PGN, the state company, and PLN, the electrical generator, was the massive gas cell from the corridor block to West Java. So really extraordinary period in the gas industry. Interestingly, the other part of the business, that was a heritage Gulf Indonesia business. The other part of the business was based, the heritage Conoco, based in the Natuna Sea. And that had a major gas cell to Singapore and to Malaysia. And part of what I had to do was to deliver the facilities to ensure that the gas cell, particularly to Malaysia, was started and maintained, and the Singapore contract was maintained as well. So really enjoyable stuff, very clever people I worked with, and it was one of those periods in life when I can say I learned a huge amount, but there was not one single entity that I learned from, but from several, as I mentioned, including the government and some very able people who wanted outcomes that we were able to deliver for them. So really quite an extraordinary symbiosis of different wants, different needs, the company needs, the country needs, the et cetera, putting them together and being able to be part of the team that created a gas industry in Indonesia, which before in that way hadn't existed. So tremendous times, really.
Yeah. But and also, like you said, you know, you have to know the area, and now I suppose you're there. And I've heard a lot of detractors saying, you know, Indonesia, it's really hard to do business there. But that, obviously, that is not your experience there, is it?
Well, I think if you go to any foreign country, you know, people usually base their views on where they come from, and they view that location generally with rose-tinted spectacles. And then other countries become more difficult, often because they don't understand them. So, you know, if I give you a parallel. Doing business in Nigeria, people would say, well, that's really difficult to do. I wouldn't want to do that. That's difficult. This is problematic. That's problematic. You know, the underlying corruption that runs through the country. But some companies and people make a very good living in Nigeria because they understand it and they do things in the appropriate way without crossing any boundaries and such like. So Indonesia is similar in that regard. So, and you can list probably, you know, as many countries in the world as you want to, you know, Colombia where I worked, Iraq where I worked, Qatar even, which is really quite a sophisticated place to do business. And people say these countries are difficult. So Indonesia comes into that category. I would say you have to understand the country. You have to do things in a way that are done within the country, i.e. using the local people who understand what goes on. You know, you're not going to suddenly, as a foreigner, turn up on the doorstep in Indonesia and understand 1,000 years of Javanese culture and, you know, that they've been waiting for you all the time to be able to do things. You go in there, you learn, you're very respectful of the culture, you're very respectful of the people you're dealing with, and you understand how to operate. You also understand what leverage you may be able to bring to any particular situation. And if you bring leverage that is already there, say in terms of what the country or the local society and you know, local governments, which are very strong within the country, need, then, you know, generally you can get a positive outcome. If you come and you try and force an outcome that suits you and you're going to be the net beneficiary of that outcome, and there are sort of a few trinkets that, you know, using the vernacular for the locals and for the country, well, that's going to be more difficult. So Indonesia is a sophisticated place, you know, well-educated people that one has to respect and work with, and then you can do business there. But like all foreign countries, including many of them in Europe, actually, if you come from the UK, or, you know, people talk about the US being difficult if you come from the UK. Go in with your eyes wide open and learn. Don't pretend that you know everything, and be prepared to learn and be patient as you put things together. One of the things I would say about Andalus, you know, to their credit and Dave's credit, is he has built a team of people who understand how Indonesia works, both locals and expatriates, people who've been successful within the country. And I'm talking about the actual team now, not, you know, myself, but people who can actually do things and put together or point out a track record of success within that environment. So, you know, nothing's easy in the world of oil and gas industry, the oil and gas industry, wherever you are, actually. And Indonesia, in my view, is no exception to that. Now, some companies have caught a cold in Indonesia, but, you know, list me a country in the world in the oil and gas industry or the mining industry or the other extractive industries where people haven't caught a cold. And I would say, you know, it's... I don't know that there's any magical solution to it, but the way that we're going about doing things and the way the success I've had in that country and other countries in the past is about being properly respectful, learning, and then working with the local society to deliver things that are in value for everybody in the equation. So, you know, in the... I'm not sure if you're aware of the triple bottom line, as it's called, the sustainable development approach to doing business. Well, many countries, the triple bottom line is actually what you're delivering. And that means, you know, you look after yourself, you look after the state, and you look after the all of the stakeholders. Because if you don't look after the stakeholders, then it becomes very complicated. Anyway, it's a long-winded answer to your question. But as you can probably sense, it's something that I have a passion about. And when I'm involved in a country, Indonesia in this specific case, I like to see it being done properly.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, you know, we've mentioned some big companies there in the world of oil and gas. And so it's always intriguing when guys like you and Dave, you know, kind of amazing CVs there and a wealth of experience. And now, you know, dealing with a company, your company is now under a market cap of 2 million. So that must always pique some interest in why these guys... You know, previously from these massive companies, you know, it's almost doing work with a small company. So what's the deal? How did you, you know, get together with Dave? And how active will you be with Andalus? And, you know, what do you see it doing? How do you see it going forward?
Well, as I mentioned, I first met Dave when I went to Indonesia. Actually, my very first day of meeting him was in June of 2001. And I tend to work, when I was an executive, I worked at the weekends. And Dave just happened to be in the office on a Saturday afternoon. And he and I started talking about strategy, actually, interestingly, of the company. And he worked very closely with me over the next three or so years whilst I was in Indonesia, as we worked in this, as I described, extraordinary growth period within the gas industry. And over the years, I've stayed in close contact with Dave, you know, seeing what he's been doing, you know, the work through NEDO and then subsequent to NEDO work back in Indonesia. And we had a loose arrangement of saying, well, someday we'll do something together. But, you know, I really did enjoy my career within ConocoPhillips and within Talisman. And my commitment was to those companies. Now, with retirement, Dave and I spoke, and I like and trust Dave. I think he has a very good strategic brain. I think he's very good at understanding how to do things within Indonesia, other countries as well, but Indonesia specifically in this case. And I was looking for various things to do. I'm doing some other things as well as Andalus as well. And Dave and I spoke about me coming on the board, which I did my usual due diligence, and yes, you're absolutely right, it's a very small company. The company had been suspended in AIM at that time, unfortunately. You know, I think that's a different story. But nevertheless, it spoke to the need for somebody who could be, you know, Dave is very enthusiastic. He's incredibly enthusiastic. And sometimes that enthusiasm can do with a person who's a bit of a counterweight to that, to be sort of offering the contrary view. And at a board, you need that sort of conversation, that sort of rich conversation where people can take differing views and, you know, almost the context of, well, show me, rather than taking things at face value. And, you know, knowing Dave and how we've worked together in the past, and I thought this would actually be a good relationship between us. Yes, you know, joining a company on the board, the market cap is relatively low. Is you look at it and you say, well, yes, well, why are you doing that? But the amount of work and the governance one has to bring to the board, the involvement one brings to the board, is exactly the same as a large company. You know, one of the things we're setting off to do in Andalus is not to be a fly-by-night. You know, the oil and gas industry has it's an extractive industry. It has risk associated with it. But we don't want to build in additional, I'll say, board-level or hyper-selling type risk to the company. And so what we're trying to do is, in our board, and where we are now today with the strengthened board, is to have good oil and gas industry governance processes and an approach whereby the board is strong and almost with redoubtable figures within there who can stand up to each other and have a good old argument about what the company should be doing. So how much will I, and I think the other question you asked was, how much time will I be spending? Well, I'm not an executive of the company. Mm-hmm. I've spent quite a lot of time with Andalus during the this year, really, since I became chairman. But I think the value which I bring is not just going along and tagging along with Dave and saying, look, you know, I can do this as well. You know, here I am as another bloke who can do the same things. But as being that person who comes in, you know, one day a week metaphorically and sits and talks and questions and asks and, you know, drives a different agenda that the company may not see. You know, so it's relatively straightforward, but it's not. It's because of the time I've spent in the oil and gas industry, I believe that I can bring that in a way, you know, other people can bring that as well. But for our group we have at the moment, it's quite a close-knit group, but it's not a group that is going to stand back and just say, oh, yeah, let's go and do this and take the Arthur ball and go and play golf, for example. You know, yeah, we're not in that mode.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Can you just explain, you know, the strategy there, the gas to power strategy for the company, and the potential, hopefully, there?
Yeah, I think that Indonesia is electricity deficient, and that has been a situation for some time. And the area that we're operating within is Sumatra. We've looked to across Indonesia, across the whole archipelago of opportunities, but we've centered on South and Central Sumatra. And these are areas where, at best, there's an 80% electricity penetration within society. In some cases, it's much lower than that. And there are districts which, you know, it's down to 70, some even in the 60s. And the corollary to that is there is a lot of isolated gas, small in the global sense, gas fields that have not been developed because they're not material to the large companies. And one of the things that, you know, people can easily notice is, well, if there's gas and there is a need for power, the middle point is creating some kind of power system that supplies those people. And then you get into the view of, well, you know, are these people going to pay the bills? Is there going to be this problem, that problem associated with it? And what we've identified is what we think is a niche in the market, which is we have upstream oil and gas expertise, but we also have within the company the expertise to be able to put together projects around, and you know, this term of IPP, independent power plant, is effectively a project that is on a small scale, on a global sense, of delivering electricity from the gas. We don't want to get into dealing with the downstream of people paying their bills and all the rest of it. We want to be able to deliver gas to a company or an organization, maybe a local regency, a local government, or it may be PLN, the state company, or it could even be PGN, the gas provider, you know, organizations like that, where we, whatever happens downstream is opaque for us. But we put together the gas, we put together the project for delivering the electricity, and then we have a high degree of assurance that we're going to be paid for the product that we're putting into that marketplace. You know, the contractual system in Indonesia is quite good because the gas supply part is under the oil and gas regime. the government to take a very dim view of people not paying for oil and gas products, as you can imagine. And so therefore you have a cutoff point where you deliver the gas. Similarly, electricity is in great need, and the companies that we will be dealing with, the counterparties, have a great need for that electricity as well. They're also very well capitalized companies also, and they're companies that we know well. So that's really the gas to IPP model that we're pursuing. Of course, you can imagine as you get into the details of it, it can be much more complex than that. But fundamentally, that's what we're doing. But the complexity comes within the technical side. And we have, you know, for a company of our size, very good technical people who can actually understand the commercial and the technical aspects and linking those together.
Marvellous. Well, Paul, listen, you know, I think we've covered lots there, but I'm going to put you on the spot then and ask you, if you can, I'm sure you can think on your feet, because you don't get to where you are by not thinking on your feet. If you could think of sort of three bullet points as to why an investor should put you on their watch list, what would you say to someone if you had to be pinned down on 3 points?
I think it could be the same reason as to why I joined the board of the company. The first one is it's a pretty talented team, and a disproportionately talented team to the size of our market capitalization. So this is a team which really can deliver. It's a team that knows what it's doing, and it's a team that has a very good track record. So that's the first point. So I would trust in that team. The second point is that we're in a marketplace that we understand, and so that's the upstream business in Indonesia. And you know, all of the detractors about Indonesia and all of that, you know, they all have good reasons for detracting. I'm not, you know, saying people don't come up with views which are not well founded, but this is a company that understands how to do things within that environment. And if you feed it into the third point, there is a desperate need in the country for the product, i.e. the IPP-generated electricity that we're delivering. You put those three things together, you have a symbiosis of three reasons as to why this is a very good company to invest in. Yes, you know, upstream has risk associated. There's always the geology. You can't go, you know, sort of 1,000 feet under the ground and see what's going on. But technology has moved to such a state that, you know, our understanding of the subsurface has been able to reduce risk drastically over the years. And, you know, in Tuva Obi East, we have what we think is an ideal asset to be able to fulfill that strategy. And of course, you know, we're not talking about that being the only part of the business that we're going to be pursuing. But similarly, you know, we are focusing our business on Tuva Obi East and creating success out of that, and recognizing in bite-sized chunks we'll move forward. But I think those are the three. I would stand up, and if I were at Speaker's Corner, and shout those points about Andalus.
Yeah, well, listen, you're a good speaker, Paul. And, you know, that's a good thing. Well, listen, it's been lovely to chat to you and get your side of it, because I've chatted to Dave several times. So it's lovely to have you on. And by all means, don't be so shy in the future. And hopefully we can chat some more very soon.
Well, thank you, Justin. Very nice to talk to you as well. And enjoy the rest of your day in Chandler's Fort.
Okay, it's time for today's penny stock with potential, as suggested by Ant. And that's Ant Sharwood, not an ant as in an insect. That would be slightly ridiculous. Thanks, Ant, for doing this. Much appreciated. So what's the company? It's Amrit. Ticker AMYT. What does the company do? Pharmaceutical company. Of course, it was RTO'd. It was Fastnet originally. And now it's, I think it's in April, RTO'd to become Amrit. MYT. AMYT, by the way. How many shares does the company have in issue? 208 million. Market cap is 40 million. Share price of 19.5 pence. How much cash or debt does the company have? On their admission to AIM release on the 19th of April 2016, they had raised £10 million before expenses. List three reasons why you think this company has potential. Number one, orphan drug or unique orphan drug. Huge and highly competitive market. And number two, the who's who of persons forming one of the strongest board of directors on AIM for a pharmaceutical company. And number three, looking at potential NASDAQ listing in the next 12 to 18 months, a similar valued orphan drug company was bought for over £800 million from a similar market cap. So it's Amrit, AMYT, worth putting on your watch list. I've heard quite a few people mention this. Do your own research, please. But like I said, go to Vox Markets. Just type in AMYT. Click follow to receive news straight to the front screen of your phone when they release it. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
The people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to take an adventure with rugged capability and commanding style. Check out the Honda Ridgeline, Pilot, Passport, or CRV. For a limited time, well-qualified buyers can get a 1.99% APR on a 2025 Ridgeline or a 3.99% APR on a 2025 Pilot, 2026 Passport, or 2025 CRV.
See dealer for financing details.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.